We are continuing with the second commandment this morning. It's in Exodus chapter 20 at verse 4. You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that is in heaven above, or that is on the earth below, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing children for the iniquity of their parents, to the third and fourth generation of those who reject me, but showing steadfast love to the thousandth generation of those who love me and keep my commandments. And earlier, a story from Exodus chapter 3. Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led his flock beyond the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There was the angel of the Lord that appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush. He looked, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Moses said, I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then God said, Come no closer. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And said further, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their suffering, and I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians, to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the country of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. The cry of the Israelites has come to me. I have also seen how the Egyptians oppress them. So come, I will send you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? God said, I will be with you, and this shall be a sign for you that it is I who sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God on this mountain. But Moses said to God, If I come to the Israelites and say to them, The God of your ancestors has sent me, they will ask me, What is God's name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. God said further, Thus you shall say to the Israelites, I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, Thus shall you say to the Israelites, The Lord, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever and ever, and this my title for all generations. Go, assemble the elders of Israel. Say to them, The Lord, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have given heed to you and to what has been done to you in Egypt. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Now, once upon a time, a very, very long time ago, there lived a farmer, and he had a daughter. And one day, the farmer was out tilling his yard, his farm, and he saw a great procession of people coming down the road. Much to his surprise, it was the king and all of the king's companions, and they stopped and they asked this farmer if they might have a drink of water. Now, of course, the farmer obliged, and so he took the king with him, and he struck up a conversation. But being but a poor farmer, he didn't know how to speak to a king, and he was overwhelmed. And before he could even think, the words came out of his mouth, claiming that his daughter could spin straw into gold. He had no idea why he said that, because his daughter could do no thing. But the king was naturally curious and a bit skeptical, and so he invited the farmer and his daughter to the castle for a little demonstration. Feeling that they had no choice, the farmer and his daughter went up to the castle, where the king, of course, promptly locked the young girl into a round room with no windows and a pile of straw and a spinning wheel, And as the king locked the door, he said to her, "You will turn that great pile of straw into gold, and I will return in the morning, and if you have not done so, you will pay with your life." And with a slam of that great wooden door, the daughter began to weep. Because, of course, she had no such magical ability, and she was terrified of what the next morning would hold. But as she sat and cried, she heard, and a little man with a pointy nose appeared before her. And he said, "Why are you crying, miss?" And the little girl explained her situation through piteous sobs. And when she had finished, the little man simply said to her, "My dear child, I will spin that straw into gold for you if you give me something in return." Now the little girl begged him for help, but she had nothing of worth to offer. And as she began to cry harder, the tiny man with his pointy nose looked at her slyly and said, "Well, there is one thing I would like." "Yes, anything," she said. "Your firstborn child," he said. And immediately she agreed, because of course she was a young girl for whom things such as children and marriage were far beyond her realm of understanding. And so the little man began to spin. And the next morning when the king opened the door, what did he find but a pile of gold? Keeping his word, the king not only spared his life, but in time he came to marry that farmer's daughter, believing that she would make him the wealthiest man in all the land. Now many, many years passed, and in time the daughter and the king were very happy together despite their inauspicious beginnings. In time they came to expect a child, and they couldn't have been more pleased. But one day, of course, a few weeks after the child arrived, that tiny man with the pointy nose arrived again, demanding that the baby be given to him. And the mother refused, crying and sobbing, but the little man with the pointy nose reminded her of their bargain. But he relented slightly, and he offered her a new deal. "If you can guess my name in 3 days' time, then you may keep your child," he said. And the mother agreed. Immediately, she began listing off every name she could think of: Melchizedek, Fritz, Balthazar. But none was correct. The tiny man with the pointy nose left, and the queen called a messenger to her quarters and told him to go out to scour the countryside to search for this tiny man with a pointed nose to try to find out his name. And the messenger left with his mission. Now the second night went much the same as the first, names upon names upon names, but none of them was the right one. But as the third night came near, the queen considered running away with her child, but she knew that tiny man with the pointy nose would only find her. And just as she was about to give in to despair, the messenger burst through the door, saying, "Your Majesty, I found it. I came upon that tiny man with the pointy nose in the hills. He was dancing around a fire, and he was singing a song that didn't rhyme. He said, 'Today I will bake, and tomorrow I'll brew. I'll fetch the queen's child. It's just what I'll do, because Rumpelstiltskin is my name.'" When the tiny man arrived that night, the queen began her guessing. "Is it Matthew?" she said. "Ho, ho," said the little man, "it is not." "Well, how about Luke?" she said. "Wrong again," he shouted. "What about Rumpelstiltskin?" The tiny man's laughter caught in his throat. "What did you say to me?" "Rumpelstiltskin," she said. The tiny man pounded on the floor in fury, grabbed his left foot, and ripped himself in two, and that was the end of Rumpelstiltskin. Now, you are probably familiar with that up until the very final line, which is actually the way the Brothers Grimm end that story. We learned many lessons from Rumpelstiltskin as children. The first, of course, is that the Brothers Grimm had a rather violent streak to them. I really don't know of any other children's stories that end with enraged magicians ripping themselves into two pieces. But more importantly, of course, the moral of the story in Rumpelstiltskin isn't just about not promising your firstborn child, although that is not a great idea, but it's really a story about the power of names. In this story, the queen is able to manipulate and ultimately destroy Rumpelstiltskin because she knows his name. And this is something that we know not just from silly fairy stories. At my grade school, it seemed like every few years we would go through this cycle where everyone was obsessed with finding out what their given name meant. I always thought it was great that the name Kelly meant warrior. It made me feel very strong and courageous. But then once we learned that our friend Calvin's name meant little bald one, we couldn't stop teasing him for that particular choice of names. The same, of course, is true in the Bible. One of the most famous examples is Isaac, whose name means God has brought me laughter. Sarah named her son Isaac Laughter because she literally started laughing. It was so laughable to consider that she would bear a son well into her 90s. In the book of Ruth, we know about a name change with Naomi, Ruth's mother-in-law. Naomi means pleasant, but partway through the story, she changes her name to Mara, which means bitter, and she says, God has dealt bitterly with me, which when you've lost your husband and your sons, I suppose that is the case. Whether they're in fairy tales or schoolyards or Bibles, names have a real power to them, whether we think about it or not. Names give us the ability to identify and to understand and to objectify people and places and things, to understand our world around us. And so I actually think Moses' question in our story this morning makes sense. Standing there before the burning bush that's on fire but not actually being consumed, God says, Moses, you're going to go and deliver my people from slavery in Egypt. And Moses says, well, that's all well and good, God, but who am I going to tell them sent me? These people, they don't trust me. They're not just going to believe that some God sent me. What is your name? Who are you? Who is sending me? And we can almost imagine the bush in that moment kind of flashing with anger, its leaves trembling with a bit of indignation. How dare you ask me that question, Moses? And God says, tell them I am has sent you. I am who I am. Now, this is a sort of surprising turn and very contrary to, I'm sure, what Moses had hoped for, because God doesn't give Moses a proper noun or a name to take back to the people. Nouns, of course, name people, places, things. That over there, that's a baptismal font. And this here that I'm standing in is a pulpit or a lectern, like John is sitting over there today. We know nouns. They help us quantify and organize and understand the world around us. Nouns are almost like buckets in our minds. We can take something unknown, and if we can attach a name, a noun to it, we can usually kind of stick it into a bucket to help us understand and quantify things. Like a bonobo is a monkey, and a Pekingese is a dog. We take a name and we put it in a bucket. But as Moses comes to learn, God doesn't have a name like that. God does not have a noun, a proper name, because God is not going to be organized or objectified or understood in quite that way. Instead, God gives to Moses a verb, I am. I am comes from the verb both in English and in Hebrew, to be. And to be, if you have ever tried to learn another foreign language, is one of the most difficult and frustrating verbs to try to understand because we use the words to be constantly. It's one of the most used verbs in most languages. We could be saying things like I am, or you are, or that should be, or that was. All of those are different versions of to be. It creates almost limitless possibilities, past, present, future. You can talk about other people, you can talk about yourself. It's a really flexible word. And because it's so flexible, it's really hard to learn in a new language how they use that. And this would not have been the way the ancient Hebrews would have understood a name for a God. Because what God is telling Moses in this word, I am who I am, rather than a good old proper name like Zeus or Ra, is that God is saying, you are not going to be able to reduce me or contain me in a single name. I am who I am. I will be who I will be. I was who I was. All of these are sort of bound up in that word that God gives to Moses. God is saying, I'm with you and I'm present, but you're not going to be able to hold me still. Now, you might sort of rightfully so be looking at your watch thinking, we're, you know, getting further into the sermon. Where is the second commandment here, Kelly? But this has a lot to do with that question of having idols, worshiping idols, putting things before God. We're warned off of idols frequently in Scripture for a reason, and it's because idols are really attractive. They're easy, they are understandable, they help us quantify and try to control the world around us. It is much easier, I can tell you, to show up on a Sunday morning at the Temple of Zeus, uncork a bottle of wine, pour it out in front of Zeus's statue, and leave that day knowing that you have done your part to satisfy the great god Zeus. When Moses was up on that mountain a little bit later after leading the people out of slavery for many, many days, when the people began to wonder, where is Moses and what is happening? What did they do? They melted down all their gold and they built for themselves a golden calf, because it's a lot easier to touch and feel and worship and trust something that is right in front of you than it is to trust some mysterious cloud up on a mountain that has taken your leader away for an unknown amount of time. There are specific idols in and across human history for specific purposes, and we've held on to them because they give us a sense of control. And this isn't just an ancient trait, right? Like, this isn't just Zeus controls lightning and Isis is in control of the rainbow. We have idols that we look to and grasp onto now to try to give us control over our lives and the world that we live in. Our education, our wealth, our occupations, what we do with our time, our family connections, our social networks. Most frequently, I think, in America, it's our money and our possessions. We hold on to them so tightly, and it's seeking control over things that are unknowable. There's a lot of places where we're seeking that kind of refuge and security. And very often, I think it's easier to trust in a healthy balance in our retirement savings account than it is to trust in the idea of God providing for us. Now, I'm not saying that saving for retirement is a bad thing by any means, but I do think that our trust, when we put our trust into our money or our ability to control our own futures, that is in and of itself a form of idolatry. We're seeking security from something that is not God. But this is really hard to do, because we don't serve a God who gives us easy answers, who tells us just to show up on a Sunday morning, pour out some wine, and go home. We serve a God who instead says, I am. Our God is, and our God was, and our God will be. And this raises all sorts of questions about what it means to actually believe in a God who is not a thing, but is an action, is a verb in this world around us. I think in this moment, God understood that Moses and then the Israelites and even us reading this scripture today, that we're looking for something to hold on to. We're looking for something that makes sense, to partially comprehend even just a little piece of who God really is, because that's sort of a very human trait, right? Trying to understand the world that is around us. So God relents just a little bit in this story. Beyond the mystery of I am who I am, God then reminds Moses of who else God has been. God says, I'm the same God who was present with your family. I was there with Abraham and Sarah. I was present with Hagar and Ishmael. I knew and I loved Isaac and Rebekah. I watched over Jacob and Rachel and Leah and Bilhah and Zilpha. I knew their children. I have been with your family in the past, and I am with you still today. I am who I am, and I am the God of your family. And I love that, because it's as if God understands that in the depth of this mystery, God is offering us a hand, opening up a way of understanding by saying, I'm the one who's always been with you. So I think what I find in this commandment is the temptation to simplify God to a golden calf, or perhaps a vote for the political leader that I'm just certain is going to take us in the right direction this time, or seeking out the name of Rumpelstiltskin. This story and this commandment invite us to push back a little bit on that temptation to make things easy and understandable when it comes to the person of God, and instead to remember that God is, and God was, and God will be, and that God is present in the stories. God was with Adam and Eve. God was with Moses. God was present with Ruth and Naomi and with King David and the Apostle Paul and Mary Magdalene and all the rest. God invites us in this name to tell our own stories, the stories of our parents and our grandparents and our friends and our family and ourselves, and those moments where God saying, I am, has been true for us, where God has been present in our lives. And so that is what I find meaningful in this commandment. Do not worship other idols, is the positive force. Instead, remember who I am and who I have been. And in that, I say we should give thanks to the God who was and is and always will be. Amen.